Hello and welcome to the Medical Sisterhood, a podcast created in collaboration with HCP Live, dedicated to empowering female physicians by providing a platform for shared experiences, mentorship, and support. I'm your host, Mona Shariari, an associate clinical professor of dermatology at Yale University and practicing dermatologist in Connecticut. And today I am honored to be joined by a true legend and someone I'm lucky to call a friend, the ever-inspiring Dr. Melinda Gooderham. Thank you so much for joining us. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you. I was so delighted for the invitation because I love listening to your podcast or watching the podcasts.
So thus far, we've kept our podcast within the borders of the United States. So now we're venturing outside, going to Canada, not too far, you're not stepping too far out of our comfort zone. But I would love to talk a little bit more about your journey because I know for me, as an emerging thought leader, your journey has been inspiring, not just on the national stage, but also on a global level. Everything you do from teaching to advocating for patients. But just tell us a little bit about yourself and what got you here.
Sure. So I fell in love with dermatology in medical school, as I think we all did. There was nothing I wanted to do more. So I worked really hard to get one of the spots. Back in the day when I did that, there were only in my year, there were only four English-speaking positions in all of Canada.
Wow.
So it was very, very competitive. But I played my cards right and did worked with some right people and had some great mentors, and luckily I got one of those spots. So then I went to the University of Toronto where I did my residency. And that's when I had my first daughter in third year of residency. And then when I completed, I stayed in Toronto for a couple of years as my husband finished his fellowship. And then we moved out of the city. We were like not traffic people. Toronto has a lot of traffic. Moved out to Peterborough. It's about an hour and a half outside of Toronto. And I was just going to open up like a community practice. There's no dermatologist in this area, so it was the only dermatology clinic. And I guess that's probably was that blank slate that I then had to create this career that I've developed over time. So it's been very good. And opened my practice in 2006, and by 2010 is when I started doing clinical research. That really I started doing that to access great medications for patients. As you may know, that was when the psoriasis biologics were just coming onto market. There were clinical trials available. So I started doing clinical trials to access these medications for my patients. And then I caught the bug, caught the clinical trial bug.
Well, I have to say, I love that as being the motivation for doing clinical trials because some people say, well, I love the education aspect of it, being on the cutting edge of the newest therapies, but to really do it to bring access to your patients, that's definitely something that we can aspire to. Now, as one of the very few women in the clinical trial space, what gave you courage to kind of go in there in pretty much a male-dominated field and make a name for yourself?
Well, actually, in medical school, my main mentor was Lynn Gunther. I did a sun awareness project with her. Actually, had nothing to do with clinical trials, but she was actually the one that I think helped get me into dermatology. I was giving a presentation on our sun awareness project, and I was practicing with her, and she was like, "Hey, we need to work a bit on your presentation skills." And so she coached me. That was my first presentation coach was Lynn Gunther, but she was
Love
also a
that.
trialist. But that wasn't why I was working with her. But years later, when I got into clinical trials, I had that vision because she was the only female doing clinical trials in inflammatory diseases at the time. So I could totally see, she could do it. Why couldn't I do it?
Now, I have a question because I'm privileged that now that I'm in the clinical trial space, there's obviously a lot of women who are PIs as well as huge leaders in the field. But at the time when you were kind of thinking about getting more involved with clinical trials, was there anything that made you think that maybe this is going to be too difficult? Maybe it's not worth embarking on?
Yeah, well, I mean, my sort of next mentor would be Kim Papp, who I joined his research group, and he was such a great inspiration in that field and taught me so much about it. But I remember at the very beginning, he said, "Clinical trials isn't for everyone. This might not be for you, but for sure, go for it, try it out." But it did kind of make me be like, "Oh, this might not be for me." Like, "Oh, how, wondering, would I be able to do it?" But being in this city with as being the only dermatologist at the time, having all of these patients, and I was able to be in multiple clinical trials for psoriasis and when atopic dermatitis started, all of those large spaces, we were able to recruit a lot of patients. I have an amazing team. We opened a second location. So it just kind of blossomed from there. But as I said, I caught the bug. And once you start doing it, and then you really are changing people's lives. Like you're meeting people who've been suffering with these diseases for decades sometimes. And to be able to bring them this new therapy that completely 100% clears their skin disease, you see this transformation. And that's, I think, what's addictive to dermatology in general, but particularly in clinical trials. Like, as you say, you're at the cutting edge, you're using all these new treatments that are providing levels of improvement we just hadn't seen with conventional therapies.
Well, and I think you bring up a really important point. Dermatology is unique in the sense that people can see their skin, which means they can see their disease, and they're probably more impacted from a psychosocial standpoint. But when we treat them with therapy, they can also see that improvement. So, like you said, we can have that meaningful impact on them. But in contrast, like a diabetes trial, hypertension trial, they see it too. And the hugs and the tears. I sometimes feel like the patients that I do the least for are sometimes the most grateful for everything that's been done. But I know you'd mentioned on working on presentation skills. Obviously, being at the cutting edge means you have access to data that sometimes you're the first person that's going to be presenting on the podium. So, what are your tips in terms of how individuals can really make that impactful clinical message when they're up there?
Well, really, I think part of like having the patient stories and seeing those life transformations and being able to tell that story. I don't know if you ever listened to the Smart List podcast, but you're not supposed to say storytelling, translation or sharing whatever. But yeah, it's storytelling, but being able to do it in an effective way. And I've been at many talks in my career where some people have amazing before and after photos, right? Like they put up the bad photo and then show the clear skin, and that's great. But if it doesn't come along with a story that you can connect with or that causes some emotion, it doesn't land as well, right? So having the photos is one thing, but knowing your patients and being able to tell their story and how they've overcome whatever obstacles or how their lives have changed, I think that's where the real richness is, and that's how you connect with your audience. And that's, I think, the most important thing about public speaking is that audience connection, telling that story that's bringing some emotion and leaving that impact.
I think that's actually so important. I was just doing a speaker training over the weekend, and I remember telling them that I like to leave the audience with some tidbits that pulls on their heartstrings because that can oftentimes get them to remember the talk. They may not remember anything you said, but they'll remember that picture. They'll remember that story, and hopefully the impact and how they felt, they can translate that to treating a patient with a certain medication down the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you'd mentioned this, and I know both of us know this. We have some brilliant colleagues who, I'm telling you, they know way more than I do. They have to dumb it down to my level for me to understand, but sometimes they are not as charismatic on stage and they can't get their message across. What tips do you have for someone like that who's trying to be more impactful but just doesn't know how to do it naturally?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing I've had like throughout my career, a number of different like speaking coaches, whether it's just been a one day session or someone who, follows you along for a little while while you make some changes. So I always think it's always helpful to have that extra feedback, having the other viewpoint. So Dr. Gunther, for sure, she was the first one to give me feedback. Even Kim Papp, we would do a lot of speaking together because he would, be the main PI of a trial, and they would have some other trialists speaking on the data. And he would also give me feedback. I would stop breathing and my voice would raise, and he'd say, "Yeah, you just don't raise your voice so much." And I didn't even realize I was doing it. So
Love the honesty.
taking the feedback from others, from your colleagues, but getting some professional feedback. And it's great that you were in a course this weekend because you probably took away so much from that. And especially when you can practice the skills that you learn, I think it's really important as well.
Well, and I think that's so important because some of us who are experienced speakers, we may think we don't need that coaching. I can't tell you how many of these sessions I've gone to, and I've still walked away with pearls. I've incorporated that next week into lectures that I'm giving. So I don't think you're ever too experienced to take away
No,
some
no.
pearls.
I have the TED Talk book on my bedside table. Like if I'm what in between novels, or if I want a break from what I'm currently reading, I read a chapter from the TED Talk book. I on LinkedIn, I follow a lot of like presentation coaches or communication coaches with their tips. I have daily reminders through when I'm scrolling through my LinkedIn about things to think about, how to make things better. It's a constant learning, constant journey of improvement.
I love that. I had a mentor of mine once tell me, whenever you think you're done learning is a day that you should retire. As long as you're still out there, just keep on trucking through. Now let's take it to the next level, because getting on the national stage is one thing, but how can our listeners kind of level up the experience and become a global KOL and speaker?
So you should take every speaking opportunity that you have, whether it's local, regional, national. You don't know who's in the audience, right? There's going to be other dermatologists, but there may be some industry partners there. There may be someone from different societies, say the IEC or the IPC, different groups that they're always looking for speakers for different events, different conferences. So if you are the one that connects with the audience, leave some emotion, as you said, tugging on the heartstrings. If you are the speaker on that panel that does that, they're going to remember you. And when next time they're looking for a speaker, you're going to come to mind. So it doesn't matter how small the session is that you're speaking at, make it the best you can. Use all the skills that you've learned in your recent course or whatever online, if you're following a presentation coach or a communication coach online. Always practice, always do the best that you can, because someone is going to remember your name and they're going to reach out, which I think is also important to be reachable online, whether it's through, I think LinkedIn is probably the best way to do that, but they have to find you. And sometimes it's not always easy to find someone's email. So make sure that you are out there and that you are reachable to get that invitation.
I think that's so important. The reachable piece of it, because I have a mentor who told me that when someone reaches out to you, within 24 hours, just respond to them, whether it may be that, hey, I got your message and I'll get back to you. Because especially in those instances, they want to make sure that that message actually got to you and it didn't go into some black hole. But also, I remember being told once upon a time that every time you're on the stage, you're auditioning for your next lecture. So bring your A game and give it 150%, because you don't want to be that one time that you're phoning it in, and that's when you had some critical people in the audience.
Exactly. No, I couldn't agree more.
And then now let's talk travel, because being a global key opinion leader, it can seem glamorous on Instagram and LinkedIn. We've all seen the posts, but that's really a highlight reel. There's a behind the scenes to it all. So what's that real cost of the global visibility, and how do you balance which activities are worth it and which activities can you say no to?
Yeah, I think I listened to one of your previous events where you talked about the four F's, which is
Yes.
funny because I hadn't thought of it. I mean, those things are going through my mind, but I hadn't put it to that. So it was what? Fun, family, fortune, and fame.
Yes.
The four. So those are exactly the things that I think about when there's an opportunity. One, is it a place I would love to go, or a culture that I want to experience, would be one of the first things. But again, what else can it lead to in the future? Is it a larger meeting where I'm going to meet other dermatologists to connect with? But it's choosing the right options there. Also looking at your schedule and how it's going to affect, because as you know, as a mother and a speaker and a dermatologist, you're being pulled in every direction. So when you go one way, you're coming from somewhere else. So if you're leaving your family, you have to make sure that you're not missing out something. The other cost is travel's not always predictable. So I missed my daughter's birthday one year. I was stuck in Cartagena. I couldn't, my flight home was canceled completely. So I flew to Miami. I spent the night on a bench in the Miami airport because there was no open lounge, and it was too late then to go to a hotel because I had an early flight in the morning. So I basically sat on a bench in the Miami airport feeling sorry for myself because the babysitter had to take all these girls out to the movies and for lunch. And I'd still to this day, I don't know if my daughter ever forgave me for that, but Those things are unpredictable. You can't get upset over them, or it will like ruin your week. Lots of times flights canceled and just being tired. And when you get back home, and a lot of times we fly home on a Sunday night, and guess what you're doing Monday morning at 8 o'clock? You're heading to clinics. So there's not a lot of time in there to recuperate.
Exactly. That mom guilt is real because as a new mom, I had never felt torn in so many different directions. I'm happy where I am, but I want to be home. And then when I'm home, I'm thinking about the opportunities out there. So it's this constant tug of war in my head. Now,
Been
I
there.
know you've definitely presented through jet lag, tech failures, cultural curveballs. How do you stay sharp? Because I know if I'm going to Europe and I'm functioning on 3 hours of sleep, it's really hard to bring my A game.
Yeah, I mean, a good cup of coffee. There's lots of great coffee in this world, so
You're
that
so
always
tiny in Europe, though.
have a couple of them. Another sort of interest of mine is sleep. I follow a lot of sleep experts on LinkedIn as well, and read books about sleep and things like that. I always think if I didn't do dermatology, if I had to redo it, I'd probably be a sleep specialist, because I think sleep, and honestly, like for us and how it affects us, but our patients, like the atopic dermatitis patients who aren't sleeping. And the more I learn about the impact of sleep, the more important I think it really is for overall health. But the week before I'm going away on a trip, I really try to make sure I'm getting 8 hours of sleep every single night. You can get busy and get to bed late. You might wake up early, but I really aim for 8 hours every night, and it's not great if I don't get it. Like, plan ahead and make sure you're well rested before that trip. If you do have that one night with 3 hours, it doesn't hit so hard.
That's actually such a great recommendation. And I think I'm going to start following some of these individuals because, as the mother of a 9-month-old and someone who travels, I could definitely use more sleep.
Yeah, I'll send you some links. So some great people.
Perfect.
The
It's funny, I had
other
to.
thing I found is I actually have sleep apnea, which runs in my family. My dad had sleep apnea, my brother had sleep apnea, and then my sister was just diagnosed.
Okay.
I'm tired all the time, but I live a lifestyle that's not really surprising. When I say I'm tired, I don't know why I'm tired. People are like, well, you don't know why you're tired? Like, look at your schedule. I'm like, no, I'm more tired than I should be. And so I did a sleep apnea test, and I do have it. So yeah, with my
So
CPAP.
that's actually
I don't
important
travel with my CPAP, but I
to.
do.
But I think it's important to remember to take care of ourselves. And if something feels off, because it's easy to just brush it off as it's fatigue, we're running around the world, literally. But there is definitely more to that. I do remember on the sleep front, I was having an MRI. It was like 45 minutes and I fell asleep. And the nurse came in and said, "Did you take a nap?" I'm like, "Nobody's calling for me. Nobody's crying." And that noise from the MRI was like white noise to my brain.
It's loud in there. I had one too. So
Now, we kind of talked about the digital presence on LinkedIn, especially so people can reach you. And I know a lot of newer emerging KOLs, they may not be as active on LinkedIn or not know how to really engage on social media. What tips do you have to make it professional, not like Facebook or Instagram, but also really highlight their skills?
I think you have to. It's hard, and I think as women, we're not that great at selling ourselves as far as like what we're good at, and we're being modest and things like that. But you have to just get over that and post things, post your accomplishments. But also, and you are the best at this, is always like being the cheerleader for the other women. And I try to do that as well, to be like, great job. Like, it just takes a second for a comment, but it can elevate the number of times it's shown. I don't know how the metrics work there, but just commenting on posts, liking posts. And that's the one thing that I will, as I mentioned, that I tell the younger, the newer to practice derms is, get a LinkedIn account and do a post. I'll comment on it. I'll like it. And then you'll get used to it. And then you'll find out they don't have their privacy settings on right. So then you can't tag them. And then I'm messaging them. I'm like, hey, change your privacy settings. I can't tag you. I'm trying to elevate it, but it's all of these background things that they need to know about too.
And that's, I think, really important. You hit the nail on the head in terms of, as women, we're just not good at self-promoting. And when I started to become more active on LinkedIn, it was hard. And to this day, there are some posts where I'm just like, does this come off as me bragging about myself? And you read it 50 times trying to make sure it comes off the right way. I kind of wonder if our male counterparts go through it that many times in their head, or they just click post and they move on.
I'm pretty sure that's how it is. I'll sometimes ask my husband to like, can you read this? Like, does this sound okay? And what he'll say to me, like, it must be so hard to live in your head. Like, he really can't understand how what we go through for every little decision that we make. He's like, I can't imagine that.
Yeah, my husband just says it's very simple up there. He's like, there's not a lot going on. Now, I know for me, like imposter syndrome was something that I struggled with when I first got to the space. And even to this day, like I have had talks where I didn't realize, for example, there'd be 2,000 people in the audience and I walk in the room and I'm like, whoa. And I can feel the palpitations. Do you ever feel like that at this stage?
You mean, yeah, like when you asked me to do this podcast, I'm me, like, did she, mix me up with someone else? No, and, imposter syndrome, I don't think that's something we'll ever completely get over. You have to, constantly tell yourself, like, oh, well, they did ask me back. Like, I gave this talk and they asked me back. Like, I must have done something right because they wanted me. So when I am giving a talk, I'm still nervous every time. I did a late breaker at the AAD, which talk about intimidating, the late breaking session, one of the most popular sessions, and you're presenting this data for the whole group of authors, the whole group of investigators, for our industry partner, and you feel the pressure on. So I go a bit early and I sit in the front row waiting for my turn, and I just do box breathing. Okay, four in, hold it for four, four out, hold it for four. And I just sat in the front row and I did box breathing, for the three talks ahead of me. And then when I got up, and I was well prepared. I knew what I wanted to say. I knew the major points, and it went over very well. And I was happy with my presentation. A lot of great feedback, but it was nerve-wracking. It was not, and I was giving a talk the other day and my friend texted me. She's like, oh, I wish I could be as, comfortable as you presenting. And I was like, really? Are you crazy? Like, my heart was up there. My heart was racing. I was like, what am I going to say next? And but I guess from the audience perspective, I have it held together. So that's good to know.
Well, I can definitely echo that sentiment because when you're up on the stage, you own the stage. I just feel that you're so comfortable. And it's something for me to aspire to, but I think it's also humbling to realize even after the many years of trials and the many years of being on the podium, there's still that nervousness that kicks in, which I think makes you even better speaker because you're not someone who's going to just phone it in. You're going to always put in that time and effort to prepare. And I've always felt that you know a lot more than some of the male counterparts that were on stage with you. I'm going to say it.
I do. I practice, and I don't know if you know this on PowerPoint, there is a practice coach. Do you know that feature
I
of
did not
PowerPoint?
know about that.
So it says rehearse with coach, and there's an option. So it pops up, the little window pops up, and then you have to say, feedback throughout, or there's you just uncheck that. Otherwise, it's popping up saying, like, giving you messages the whole time you're presenting. So I uncheck the constant feedback. And you just practice your talk. Number one, it helps you with timing, which is the number one thing. You don't want to be going over and want some of these talks. That's another thing. You don't want people thinking, oh, she always goes over. You want to stay in time. But it will tell you if you're using too many filler words, how your pitch is, your tone, your speed. And you get this report at the end of your rehearsal that tells you what to work on, or it will say, stop reading slide number six. You just read it word for word. So it's
Wow.
really a good feedback. And I also probably practice maybe three or four times before I give any talk.
I actually am going to start using that. That's very helpful because I'm the same way. I do re not rehearse, but you practice your talk so you kind of know what you're going to say. And when you have a finite amount of time, it's even more important to be deliberate with every point as opposed to going on tangents. But kind of bringing me to my last question, what are the tips and tricks to get invited back? So you mentioned staying on time, obviously, but sometimes when you come back, what do you think about your talk really made an impact?
Yeah, so if you to be invited back, yeah, you want to make sure you've connected with the audience for sure. Stay on time, as you just mentioned. But you also want to be easy to work with. I've been on some panels where not everybody has been the easiest to work with, and you don't often always see those people invited back. So just being a good person, I mean, it's like, what did they say? What did you learn in kindergarten? Those simple rules. Just be a good person. Be easy to get along with. But bring your passion, right? I was reading this other post on LinkedIn about, telling a story is one thing and you can make it as dramatic as you want. But if you don't feel it inside, that's going to show. So that's why when you're telling a patient's story, Make sure it's one that you really felt about, because that's going to come across in your lecture when you're sharing that patient story. So connect, use emotion that you really feel, bring the energy to the audience, use your voice, use your body, gesture, and just be great to work with. And you'll get invited back, because even if not to that meeting, somebody in the audience is going to say, we want that speaker at our next meeting.
I absolutely love that. Do you ever take your family with you to some of the global events that you speak at?
So tomorrow we are going on a family trip before the ICD 2025 in Rome. We're going to Sicily for a week, so with my family. So every year we do one big trip. We've been to South Africa. Went on a safari for a family trip. We went to Paris when Spin was there. And I'm embarrassed to say that even my honeymoon was after the World Congress in Paris when I was a resident. I was like, okay, meet me in
Dedication.
at the end of the meeting and we'll go to our honeymoon. Yeah. So my daughter said to me the other day, she's like, it seems like all of our big family trips is when you go to a conference. I was like, yeah, that's kind of how it works.
Dermatology picks good destinations. What are you going to do? I'm sure that'll be amazing. Italy is by far my favorite place to visit. I have not been to Sicily yet, but I'm sure
Surface, but I need
it
to.
will be absolutely amazing. I actually, this is a little secret of mine. I don't tend to go the week before if I'm going to take family with me. I take them the week after because I'm so nervous about my talks that I can't focus and have a good time. So people think I'm totally with it when I'm at the talks. No, I'm nervous until I'm done. When I'm done, then I can relax.
No, and I prefer that as well, but just with exam time and summer jobs, when your kids get older, they have lives too that you'd have to try to work around.
Something to look forward to, of course. Well, just with everything that we've gone through, just if you could think of one thing that you hope your daughter might remember about everything you've done, not just nationally, but on a global scale, what do you think she might remember?
I think, I have three girls, and I think they know that I work hard. They know that I support women in medicine and just in general. And I, my youngest one, who's 15, she just got selected to be on the Women's Issues and Advisory Council at her school, which I thought was very sweet. She's in grade 10, but she was so excited to come home and tell me that she was on this Women's Advisory Council for her high school. So I think they that. Clearly has come through to them. And I hope they will think about that for me and carry that on through their own careers as well.
That's so amazing because with just one action, you've touched so many lives, and this ripple effect will no doubt continue. And I'm hoping that all these efforts will pave the way for the next generation of female physicians and leaders. But I just want to thank you profusely for giving us your time this evening because, like I said, there's a lot of things you can do, and you are a very busy individual. So thank you so much for one, supporting the sisterhood, but also for everything you do behind the scenes for patients and female leaders. Do you have any final thoughts for us, Melinda?
No, thank you for having this program, because I think there are so many young women dermatologists or other specialties who may be listening in who want to have the same career path. And I think hearing the conversations and knowing that it's possible will bring that for them as well.
Absolutely. So, to our listeners, we're so happy to have you as a part of our community and grateful that you tuned in today. And we look forward to connecting with all of you during our next episode. And remember, together we can accomplish anything. You've got this. Thank you.